Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Hello, you are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. The following recording is intended solely for the use of blind, visually impaired, and print format disabled individuals. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post for Saturday, October 16th, 2021. My name is Doug Crane. 4 counts of vehicular homicide, 23 other charges. Trucker in I-70 pileup guilty. By Matt Sebastian, The Denver Post. The driver of a semi-trailer who barreled down Interstate 70 with failing brakes, slamming into stopped traffic in Lakewood and killing 4 people in a fiery 28-car pileup, was convicted Friday of more than 24 criminal charges, including vehicular homicide. Rogel Aguilera Medeiros, 25, faces decades in prison when he is sentenced in December after jurors largely agreed with Jefferson County prosecutors who argued during the nearly 3-week trial that the trucker's loss of control on April 25, 2019 was a crime, not an accident. This is the result of the defendant doing anything but caring about others that were on the road that day, Deputy District Attorney Kayla Wilderman said during closing arguments Friday morning, telling jurors that Aguilera Medeiros displayed extreme indifference. The crash killed Miguel Angel Lamas Arellano, 24, William Bailey, 67, Doyle Harrison, 61, and Stanley Politano, 69. 6 others were injured. After deliberating for more than 6 hours, the jury found Aguilera Medeiros guilty on 4 counts of vehicular homicide, 6 counts of first-degree assault, 10 counts of attempted first-degree assault, 4 counts of careless driving causing death, 2 counts of vehicular assault, and 1 count of reckless driving. The jurors, however, acquitted Aguilera Medeiros on an additional 15 counts of attempted first-degree assault. Several jurors and members of the victims' families declined to discuss the verdict with the Denver Post, as did representatives of the 1st Judicial District. 2 men and 2 women who were in the courtroom to support Aguilera Medeiros hugged him before he was taken into custody. He is scheduled to be sentenced December 13th. On the day of the crash, Aguilera Medeiros drove his semi-trailer full of lumber down I-70 at speeds in excess of 85 miles per hour, forcing other vehicles off the road before smashing into standstill traffic under a bridge near Colorado Mills Parkway in Lakewood. He passed and failed to use a runaway truck ramp and was aware that he was losing his brakes, prosecutors said. The crash sparked fires as the lumber on Aguilera Medeiros' truck ignited, with temperatures on the highway reaching more than 2,500 degrees, authorities said. That portion of the interstate remained closed for more than 24 hours. This is the result of the defendant pulling over near Berthoud Pass because his brakes were smoking away, but he chose to get back in that truck and keep driving, Wilderman told the jury. Aguilera Medeiros testified this week that as he descended into the metro area with his brakes failing, he attempted to hit the edge of a parked 18-wheeler's trailer to slow down, then tried to steer toward a space between the stopped traffic. But once I hit it, I was unable to control anything, he testified. I thought, dear God, don't let anything bad happen. At the moment of my impact, I closed my eyes and I hugged the wheel. In his closing argument, defense attorney James Colgan described Aguilera Medeiros as an inexperienced driver who became overwhelmed by the situation and made the best decisions he could. He discounted prosecutors' attempts to portray Aguilera Medeiros' actions as extreme indifference, a legal qualification for some of the charges, and said the driver was guilty of, frankly, negligence at best. They would have you believe that we have a killer sitting in this courtroom, Colgan said. They say he's a killer. He's not a killer. He's a flawed human being. Yes, he's made mistakes in his life, absolutely, but he is not a killer. In fact, Colgan argued, Aguilera Medeiros was as traumatized by the events of that day as many of the others caught up in the crash. He was as much a victim of an accident in the sense that it came upon him without warning, without any kind of indication of what he could do, the defense attorney said, and he was overwhelmed by the circumstances. But Wildman, the prosecutor, reminded the jury that in the end, the trucker's bad decisions took four members of our community. Denver Post reporter Kieran Nicholson contributed to this report. Art scandal. Six relics still at Denver Museum. Objects, none on display, tied to late art dealer. By Sam Tabachnik, The Denver Post. The Denver Art Museum is in possession of six ancient relics from Cambodia and Thailand that are at the center of an international art scandal. The revelation came as part of the Pandora Papers, a series of reports by a coalition of investigative journalists released last week that used a cache of previously secret tax documents to show how some of the world's richest and most powerful figures stashed assets and shielded their wealth overseas. One of those figures is Douglas Latchford, a now-deceased art dealer who assembled one of the world's largest private collections of Cambodian treasures that date back to the Khmer Empire more than 1,000 years ago. Federal prosecutors charged Latchford in 2019 with a host of crimes associated with the pillaging and illegal selling of ancient artifacts. But the Pandora Papers identified at least 27 relics with ties to Latchford still sitting in museums around the world. Six of those objects are in the Denver Art Museum, four from Cambodia and two from Thailand, museum officials confirmed this week. None of the objects is on display. Immediately after the indictment of Douglas Latchford in 2019, the museum contacted officials in Cambodia to gather additional information about the four pieces from that country, museum officials said in the statement. The museum has been in conversation with both the U.S. and Cambodian governments regarding those objects and their return. The four Cambodian works, the museum said, were deaccessioned or officially removed from the museum's listed holdings in September as officials worked to return them to Cambodia. Neither the museum nor the Pandora Papers identified the four items. The museum is still conducting research related to the two objects from Thailand, officials added, which consist of an 18th or 19th century cabinet and a Neolithic vessel. Cambodian artifacts long have been subject to looting, beginning in the 1970s under Pol Pot's dictatorial genocidal regime. As a result, authorities there have spent the better part of four decades seeking to reclaim lost items that have migrated around the globe. Latchford's 2019 indictment showcases how he allegedly deceived art collections, including a Colorado museum, by fabricating invoices and other records documenting these objects' history and origin. Around 2000, Latchford sold a 12th century stone Khmer sculpture to the Colorado Museum. Court documents didn't specify which one, prosecutors said. He supplied the museum with letters of provenance, the history of the artwork's ownership, claiming to have purchased the piece from a collector the year prior. But that collector died in 2001, and prosecutors said Latchford continued to provide false letters from the individual, claiming the person was still alive. Latchford died last year before his case could go to trial. Colorado connections to the international investigation didn't end there. Journalists on the Pandora Papers project identified some of the relics still in circulation using Latchford's 2011 Khmer Bronzes book, which he co-wrote with a prominent Colorado scholar, art professor, and former Denver Art Museum board member named Emma C. Bunker. Bunker and Latchford enjoyed a 30-year friendship, collaborating on three books exploring Khmer art. She was affiliated for more than 40 years with the Denver Art Museum before her death this year, serving on the museum's board of trustees and as a volunteer helping the museum secure lecturers and speakers for the Asian Art Department's public programming, museum officials said. But the two also apparently were referenced in a 2016 criminal complaint by Manhattan's district attorney as co-conspirators in a scheme helping a prominent New York gallery owner, Nancy Weiner, falsely document the history of looted Cambodian relics, the New York Times reported in 2017. Neither Latchford nor Bunker was named in the criminal complaint, but the Times reported that he was the individual identified as co-conspirator number one and she was co-conspirator number two. The Denver Post could not find any record that Bunker was charged in connection with the complaint. Prosecutors at the time pointed to seized emails that allegedly showed Latchford and Bunker making up ownership histories for various items. In one email, co-conspirator number one tells Wiener that he typically gives co-conspirator number two bronze statues in exchange for false letters of provenance, according to the criminal complaint. Andy Sinclair, a spokesperson for the Denver Art Museum, said in a statement that Bunker had given funds and given the museum several pieces that sit in the Asian art, art of the ancient Americas, textile art and fashion, and architecture and design collections. The museum is aware of the 2017 New York Times article and is committed to ethical collection practices and engages in ongoing provenance research for objects in its collection, including works related to this inquiry, Sinclair said in the statement. The Denver Art Museum has already returned one item it obtained from the Wiener Gallery, which New York authorities raided in 2016 as part of a string of takedowns involving looted South Asian antiquities. Less than 3 weeks before the raid, museum officials in Denver announced they had returned a 10th-century sandstone sculpture to Cambodia. The 6-foot-tall piece, Torso of Rama, had been acquired from the Doris Wiener Gallery in 1986. Nancy Wiener is Doris's daughter. The Cambodian government had contacted the museum as part of its efforts to return a cadre of ancient artifacts stolen during its 1970s Civil War. After Bunker's death this year, the Denver Art Museum launched the Emma Cadwalader Bunker Asian Art Acquisitions Fund in her honor. A celebration of her life will be held at the museum in June to honor her academic and scholarly contributions to the field of Asian art and in memory of a dear friend with a warm heart that made everyone feel welcome, the museum said on its website. COVID-19 in Colorado. Hospitalizations hit a high for the year. Approximately 90% of intensive care beds in state are now full. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. Colorado's COVID-19 hospitalizations are higher than they have been at any time since we bid 2020 a less than fond farewell. And about 90% of intensive care beds in the state are full. As of Friday afternoon, 983 people were hospitalized across the state with confirmed cases of COVID-19, which was the highest number since December 31st. At the peak of the deadly winter wave on December 2nd, there were 1,841 people hospitalized with confirmed cases. Scott Bookman, the state's COVID-19 incident commander, asked anyone who is eligible and hasn't gotten vaccinated to get the COVID-19 vaccine and seasonal flu shots to reduce strain on hospitals. About 77% of people hospitalized with COVID-19 in Colorado are unvaccinated. 2 weeks ago, Colorado had about 166 new cases for every 100,000 people and was doing better than the majority of states, state epidemiologist Dr. Rachel Herlihy said. As of Thursday, the rate had increased to 268 cases per 100,000 people, which was the 14th highest rate in the country, she said. That reflects increasing cases in Colorado and an improving situation in the South. That's a really significant change for us, she said during a news briefing Friday. New cases rose 16% last week after climbing 5% the week before, Herlihy said. There's some indication this week might be a bit better, but it's going to take several weeks of steady improvements before Colorado can say the worst is over, she said. Although Herlihy still referred to the situation as a high plateau, she acknowledged recent increases could be the start of another spike. Generally, respiratory viruses spread more efficiently in the winter, although SARS-CoV-2 hasn't always played by those rules, she said. This is one of those cases where my epidemiology crystal ball isn't very clear, she said. Cases are highest in children 6 to 11 who aren't eligible for vaccination, and those 12 to 17 who are, Herlihy said. They're also particularly increasing on the Eastern Plains, in the Southwest counties, and in the San Luis Valley, she said. Bookman urged people who haven't been vaccinated to get the Pfizer shot by Thursday or the Johnson & Johnson shot by November 11th to ensure they're fully protected by Thanksgiving. It takes about 2 weeks after the final shot for the body to mount an immune response. We really want to make sure people are thinking ahead, he said. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that unvaccinated people get tested in the days before and after they travel or put off non-essential trips. All people need to monitor themselves for symptoms and wear masks in indoor spaces, such as airports and trains, the CDC said. People also can protect themselves by wearing masks, practicing social distancing during their gatherings, moving events outside, opening windows to increase ventilation, requiring everyone to get tested in advance, limiting gatherings to vaccinated adults, and hosting smaller events, Herlihy said. We want individuals to protect themselves, protect their families, she said. Texas. DOJ will ask justices to halt abortion law. By Paul J. Weber, The Associated Press. Austin, Texas. The Biden administration said Friday it will turn next to the U.S. Supreme Court in another attempt to halt a Texas law that has banned most abortions since September. The move comes as the Texas clinics are running out of avenues to stop the GOP-engineered law that bans abortions once cardiac activity is detected, which is usually around 6 weeks. It amounts to the nation's biggest curb to abortion in nearly 50 years and makes no exceptions for cases of rape or incest. By going to the Supreme Court, the Justice Department is taking the route that clinics have sought as other legal challenges have failed. In the meantime, Texas women have turned to abortion clinics in neighboring states, some driving hours through the middle of the night and including patients as young as 12 years old. People are scared, confused, and other than very early abortion, have nowhere to turn to access safe, legal abortion unless they are able to travel hundreds of miles to another state, said Jeffrey Hans, president of Planned Parenthood South Texas, whose clinics have stopped offering all abortion services since the law took effect September 1st. The latest defeat for clinics came Thursday night when a federal appeals panel in New Orleans, in a 2-1 decision, allowed the restrictions to remain in place for a third time in the past several weeks alone. Justice Department spokesman Anthony Coley said the federal government will now ask the Supreme Court to reverse that decision, but did not say how quickly. The court has allowed the restrictions to take effect, but did so without ruling on the law's constitutionality. The Texas Attorney General's office called Thursday night's decision by the 5th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals a testament that we are on the right side of the law and life. A 1992 decision by the U.S. Supreme Court prevented states from banning abortion before viability, the point at which a fetus can survive outside the womb, around 24 weeks of pregnancy. But Texas's law has outmaneuvered courts so far because it offloads enforcement to private citizens. Anyone who brings a successful lawsuit against an abortion provider for violating the law is entitled to claim at least $10,000 damages, which the Biden administration says amounts to a bounty. Only once has a court moved to put the restrictions on hold, and that order stood for just 48 hours. During that brief window, some Texas clinics rushed to perform abortions on patients past 6 weeks, but many more appointments were canceled after the Fifth Circuit moved swiftly to reinstate the restrictions last week. Texas had about 24 abortion clinics before the law took effect, and operators have said some may be forced to close if the restrictions stay in place for much longer. Texas Right to Life, the state's largest anti-abortion group, set up a tip line to receive allegations against abortion providers but has not filed any lawsuits. Kimberly Schwartz, a spokeswoman, said Thursday the group expected the Biden administration to go to the Supreme Court next and was confident Texas will ultimately defeat these attacks on our life-saving efforts. Already, the stakes are high in the coming months over the future of abortion rights in the U.S. In December, the new conservative majority on the Supreme Court will hear Mississippi's bid to overturn the landmark Roe v. Wade decision that guarantees a woman's right to an abortion. On Wednesday, 18 state attorneys generals from mostly GOP-controlled states threw new support behind the Texas law, urging the court to let the restrictions stand while accusing the federal government of overstepping in bringing the challenge in the first place. Last month, more than 20 other states, mostly run by Democrats, had urged the lower court to throw out the law. U.S. Attorney General Merrick Garland has called the law clearly unconstitutional and warned that it could become a model elsewhere in the country unless it is struck down. Washington. Committee on Reforming Supreme Court appears to support term limits. by Jessica Gresko, the Associated Press. Washington, a commission tasked with studying potential changes to the Supreme Court, has released a first look at its review, a draft report that is cautious in discussing proposals for expanding the court, but also speaks approvingly of term limits for justices. The 36-member bipartisan commission, largely composed of academics, has been studying court reform and holding hearings, but it was not charged with making recommendations under the White House order that created it. As a result, much of the 200 pages of materials the commission released Thursday night are history and context for reform proposals. A final report from the committee is expected in about a month and would go to the president then. Even when the commission does finish its work, however, any proposals for change would be met with serious political headwinds, particularly with midterm elections looming and the chance that Democrats could lose control of Congress. The commission's review was a campaign promise President Joe Biden made amid pressure from activists and Democrats to react after the court's composition tilted sharply to the right during President Donald Trump's term. Trump nominated three justices to the high court, giving it a 6-3 conservative majority. Democrats were especially frustrated that the Republican-led Senate kept former President Barack Obama from filling the seat left empty for months by the death of conservative Justice Antonin Scalia in 2016. Then, with Trump in office, the Senate pushed to confirm Amy Coney Barrett to the court after the death of liberal Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg weeks before the election. That led to calls by some progressives for reforms, including adding seats to the court or setting term limits. The commission devoted a significant section of the materials it released to discussing term limits for the justices, who under the Constitution have life tenure. The commission described term limits as the proposal that appears to have the most widespread and bipartisan support. It said a politically diverse array of scholars has endorsed term limits and that a survey of literature on the subject by the commission discovered few works arguing against term limits. The commission said that three current justices, Chief Justice John Roberts, Justice Stephen Breyer, and Justice Elena Kagan, have noted the potential benefits of term limits. It also cited experts recommending an 18-year term limit for justices and said term limits for state high court justices are common. The report also notes that the United States is the only major constitutional democracy in the world that has neither a retirement age nor a fixed term of years for its high court justices. The commission said it was divided over whether Congress has the power to create the equivalent of term limits for justices by statute or if a constitutional amendment is required. The commission's report was cautious in addressing proposals for increasing the size of the court. It noted increasing the court's size could create a more diverse court that could handle more cases, but it also noted that the risks of court expansion are considerable, including to the court's legitimacy. The commission said most state high courts have fewer seats than the Supreme Court, but that by global standards, the Supreme Court is small, with France, Spain, and Britain among the countries with larger high courts. Other countries have found ways to make a larger court workable, the commission said, while noting that we should be cautious about assuming, however, that the U.S. Supreme Court could easily follow the lead of its international analogs. Congress originally set the size of the court at 6 members. The size has been 9 since 1869. With the commission wrapping up its work, calls for action from the Congress and the president could increase. During the presidential campaign, Biden repeatedly sidestepped questions on expanding the court, and he hasn't said if he supports adding seats or making other changes, including imposing term limits. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki has said he would not weigh in about the size of the court until the commission finished its work. Many groups are watching closely what the committee produces. Brian Fallon, executive director of the progressive court group Demand Justice, called the draft report not even close to being worth the wait, arguing that the paralysis by analysis reflected here is exactly what you would expect from a commission made up mostly of academics. He said the commission's purpose was simply to buy time for the Biden administration while it fights other legislative battles. But Alliance for Justice President Rakeem Brooks said in a statement that the report will help raise awareness that reform is not only possible but necessary. and Gabe Roth of the group Fix the Court said in a statement that the draft highlights the benefits of several popular Supreme Court reforms, including term limits that would rebuild trust in an institution whose public esteem has recently cratered. The panel is being led by Bob Bauer, who served as White House counsel for former President Barack Obama, and Christina Rodriguez, a Yale Law School professor who served in the Office of Legal Counsel for Obama. University of Colorado, student legislators strike amid calls for change, by Katie Langford, The Daily Camera. Boulder, frustrations about racism and autonomy reached the tipping point in University of Colorado's United Student Government this week, leading one branch to go on strike and campus administrators to step in while sparking conversations about rethinking how student government operates. Members of CU's Legislative Council have raised concerns about racist aggressions and not feeling heard by other student officials and campus leaders. They called out changes to a policy that allows administrators to oust student government officials. At a certain point, it became very clear to me that this is a systemic issue, said Legislative Council President Sophia Khan. It's a system that works best when people of color are harming each other or being harmed. Changes to the policy, known as the Chancellor's Agreement, has instilled fear in student leaders, Khan said. The agreement in part states that a student can be removed from a United Student Government position if, after intervention, their behavior constitutes a material and substantial disruption to the progress or continued work of CUSG. Khan said she is worried that the updated policy could be used as a retaliatory tactic against student government members who criticize campus or system administration, as the Legislative Council did when it voted to censure former CU President Mark Kennedy. The precedent that this is setting is that anything you say publicly, that's criticism, you can be fired for and lose your source of income, she said. Khan and other students voiced their concerns about racism in student government during meetings this summer and fall and haven't felt heard, she said. And although harm has been done by all sides and all branches, there has not been accountability from other student government branches, Khan said. Khan and other Legislative Council members cited an incident in which a nominee for a United Student Government position made problematic racial comments, and when concerns were raised by Legislative Council members, other student officials dismissed the concerns. In a statement, Council Vice President Nikki Garaga said she has been yelled at for not voting favorably on certain issues and has been asked to prove that things happened during meetings with video recordings because my word is not good enough to trust. I feel as though my identity as a woman of color has actively held me back in open and closed door situations where I should have been treated with the respect that I expect not only as a leader but as a human, Garaga wrote. During public comment at a September Legislative Council meeting, graduate student Holly Olivares spoke about sitting behind student officials during a previous meeting who interrupted, rolled their eyes, snickered, and talked while Khan was talking. The Legislative Council's Executive Committee is halting business as usual until there is a shift in behavior and institutional culture, the committee said in a news release this week. In a statement, CU student body presidents Kavya Kannan, Taylor Weintz, and Ben Capoloto said they are committed to helping the organization become an inclusive environment where marginalized communities feel heard and valued. In a separate statement, Chief Justice Alessandra Wilson said the judicial branch is committed to being an anti-racist body and has tried to create change. Kannan, Weintz, and Capoloto also defended the changes to the Chancellor's Agreement, stating that revising it is under their purview and comparing the changes as similar to the student conflict resolution process that applies to the larger student body. The conflict among student government leaders led Chancellor Phil DeStefano and Vice Chancellor for Student Affairs Akira Bradley Armstrong to write a letter to Wilson, Khan, Capoloto, Weintz, and Kannan on Wednesday, acknowledging the pain and trauma they have experienced and resetting expectations. Kaiser Permanente, Colorado. Nurses' Union sues for alleged understaffing, by Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. A union representing about 2,000 employees of Kaiser Permanente, Colorado, filed a lawsuit Thursday alleging that a lack of staffing was delaying care for patients. United Food and Commercial Workers Local 7, which represents nurses, pharmacists, and other providers who aren't physicians, alleged chronic staffing shortages that put patients at risk. It alleged nurses at an infusion center were overworked and couldn't monitor chemotherapy patients adequately, and that patients waited days for a response when they called with questions about potentially dangerous symptoms such as chest pain. Jessica Bidlingmeyer, Vice President of Human Resources for Kaiser Permanente Colorado, said it's absolutely not true that infusion centers are understaffed, and they've added employees to accommodate an increase in patients. They also have protocols to deal with callers who have urgent symptoms immediately, although the best thing is to call 911 for symptoms such as chest pain, she said. Bidlingmeyer called the lawsuit an attempt to gain leverage by scaring patients while contract negotiations are ongoing. She said Kaiser Permanente has hired about 1,200 people this year and is trying to fill 400 more jobs. It has been an incredibly challenging 20 months during the COVID-19 pandemic. We are proud and thankful for our frontline healthcare heroes who've worked tirelessly, providing the high-quality care and service our members and patients expect, she said in a statement. The complaint alleges patients' phone calls can sometimes go unanswered for days or weeks. Nurses allegedly were told the organization's goal was to respond to all messages within 3 months, prioritizing those that were more urgent. Registered nurses reported exasperation at this three-month goal because such a lengthy delay in responding to patients poses an extreme risk to patient safety, the complaint said. Colorado law doesn't require minimum staffing numbers for outpatient facilities, so the lawsuit relies on a provision in the union's agreement with Kaiser Permanente that requires sufficient staffing to provide safe care for patients and reasonable workloads. Because the contract doesn't include specific numbers, whether the current staffing is sufficient would be up to a judge if the lawsuit were to go to trial. The issue is separate from strikes at Kaiser Permanente facilities in California and Oregon, where unions' local contracts have expired, said Becky Sossaman, a lead registered nurse for Local 7 who works at a Kaiser Permanente urgent care facility. Since the early 2000s, staffing issues generally were resolved by bringing grievances to a committee and working through them, Sossaman said. That changed in 2019 when Kaiser Permanente cut about 10% of unionized workers, she said. There's pressure to work harder and faster with less, she said. It feels like profits before patients. Denver Rescue Mission. Left behind DIA luggage finds a second life, by Amanda Horvath. Rocky Mountain PBS. Denver International Airport handles a massive amount of luggage each year. In 2019, 69 million passengers traveled through the airport with bags in tow. Some of those travelers left their empty bags behind. Sometimes people will throw away their luggage because they want to consolidate their things to save on baggage fees, or maybe a wheel or zipper breaks and they leave a suitcase at the airport. DIA collects whatever is left behind. Once we find that luggage that is clearly being abandoned, being set next to a trash can, we don't want that just to be thrown away in a central landfill, especially when there is a higher and better purpose that it can go to, said Scott Morrissey, the Vice President of Sustainability for DIA. Enter Denver Rescue Mission. The nonprofit organization works to create lasting change in the lives of people experiencing homelessness in Denver. Part of their mission includes the Ministry Outreach Center in the Park Hill neighborhood. One part is the warehouse, the home of all of our supplies. Any non-cash donation comes through the warehouse and is received here, stored here, sorted out, and then distributed from here, explained Jesse Ludima, the director of the Ministry Outreach Center. At the Ministry Outreach Center, the abandoned pieces of luggage get a new purpose. About every month or so, Denver Rescue Mission picks up a batch of empty suitcases and bags from DIA to distribute to the unhoused community it serves. For many people in the homeless community, they have very few belongings, Ludima said. And so if you're walking around and trying to get back on your feet, having something to store your possessions in is really important. This particular partnership, with a focus on luggage donations between DIA and Denver Rescue Mission, started about 3 years ago. In 2018, Morrissey said the airport donated 835 pieces of luggage, and in 2019, it gave 719 pieces. Morrissey does say in 2020 that the number was much lower, likely because of the number of passengers who went through DIA dropped significantly because of COVID-19. Not a huge amount in the context of 69 million passengers, but they are bags that can go and have a second life and support the clients of the Denver Rescue Mission, said Morrissey. However, 2021 donations are still lower than at the start of the partnership, again with passenger numbers not quite at where they were pre-pandemic. But any donation can make a big difference in a person's life. It is a need that we don't often think of. We think of food, clothing, the essentials, but something to carry that in is critically important. So it is a need that is expressed often, Ludema said. And that need has grown even more in just the past year. The Metro Denver Homeless Initiative conducts a point-in-time count to determine how many people are experiencing homelessness in the Denver area. This year's count found the number of people experiencing homelessness for the first time doubled from 2020 to 2021. I think anyone who has worked with the homeless community here in Denver has seen the need increase for more resources, for more items just overall, Ludema said. It seems like we need to find a better way to help our homeless brothers and sisters in need. It seems now more than ever nonprofits such as Denver Rescue Mission could use the help. Thankfully, Ludema said this luggage donation partnership is just one of many beneficial partnerships. Most major grocery store chains in Colorado donate leftover food, several food banks help out regularly, and different individuals or companies often come to Denver Rescue Mission with donations. There's just probably hundreds of companies that may do drives every single year or twice a year and may say, hey, we want to get our company together and collect coats, or we want to collect hygiene products, or what is it that you need us to collect, Ludema said. I'm really blown away by people's generosity to help. And that's exactly how the relationship with DIA started. At first, it was donations of unused food from the airline flight kitchens, as well as some food and beverage concessions. Then it grew into this new baggage partnership. You can have those conversations in real time to say, you know, we have this product. Is it something that can be beneficial to people? And Denver Rescue Mission understand what those needs are, Morrissey said. It's really important for us to find those opportunities to positively contribute to the community. Just all across America, in our world, there's so many problems, Ludema said. COVID-19 vaccines. Cities, police unions clash as mandates take effect. By Bobby Kana Calvan and John Sewer, The Associated Press. Police departments around the U.S. that are requiring officers to get vaccinated against COVID-19 are running up against pockets of resistance that some fear could leave law enforcement shorthanded and undermine public safety. Police unions and officers are pushing back by filing lawsuits to block the mandates. In Chicago, the head of the police union called on members to defy the city's Friday deadline for reporting their COVID-19 vaccination status. Seattle's police department sent detectives and non-patrol officers to emergency calls this week because of a shortage of patrol officers that union leaders fear will become worse because of vaccine mandates. The standoffs are playing out at a time when many police departments are dealing with surging homicide rates and staff shortages unrelated to the vaccine. Cities and police leaders are weighing the risk of losing more officers to resignations, firings, or suspensions over their refusal to get vaccinated. Chicago's mayor on Friday filed a complaint in court against the leader of the local Fraternal Order of Police, accusing him of engaging in, supporting, and encouraging work stoppage or strike by saying the city's more than 12,000 uniformed officers should ignore the order to report their vaccination status. On Thursday, Mayor Lori Lightfoot said officers would not be sent home if they showed up to work Friday and refused to provide their information. Instead, she said, they would be put on unpaid leave after the weekend because confirming compliance would take a few days. Refusing to provide the information, Lightfoot said, would constitute an act of insubordination. John Catanzara, president of the FOP local in Chicago, said about half of his members have not been vaccinated and called a mandate requiring inoculation absolutely wrong. They were willing to go into a no-pay status at midnight tonight and get sent home, he said, suggesting during an appearance on Fox News that the city could not afford to lose police officers. You know, the reality is we have a profession nobody else wants to do right now. They cannot get anybody to go into this police academy, he said. In Los Angeles County, Sheriff Alex Villanueva said he won't force his 18,000 employees to be vaccinated despite a county mandate. I don't want to be in a position to lose 5%, 10% of my workforce overnight, he said last week. Hundreds of police officers in San Diego said they would consider quitting instead of complying with a vaccination mandate. Resistance is bubbling up, even though first responders have been hit hard by COVID-19. More than 460 law enforcement officers have died from the virus, according to the Officer Down Memorial page, which tracks deaths in the line of duty. Disputes over government and business vaccine requirements have spilled over into a variety of workplaces, including one of the nation's premier nuclear weapons laboratories and the NBA. Workers at Los Alamos National Laboratory, the birthplace of the atomic bomb, faced a deadline Friday to get vaccinated or risk being fired. A New Mexico judge denied a last-minute request by dozens of scientists and others to block the mandate. In the NBA, the Brooklyn Nets are not allowing star Kyrie Irving to practice or play until he is vaccinated. In Italy, protests erupted Friday as vaccine requirements went into effect for all workers, from magistrates to maids, to help control the spread of the coronavirus. The number of Americans getting vaccines has increased steadily in the past 3 months as boosters have become available and mandates have taken effect. The number of shots administered per day has topped 840,000 on average. No national statistics show the vaccination rate for America's first responders, but individual police and fire departments across the country have reported figures far below the national rate of 77% for adults who have had at least one dose. Police departments in Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Denver are also among those vaccine mandates or facing one. New York's mayor has said he is looking at the idea despite opposition from the city's largest police union. The union, representing some 1,000 Seattle police personnel, suggests that the mandate could worsen staffing shortages, which in turn could risk public safety. The union's president, Mike Salon, said the city's police force lost some 300 officers over the past 18 months and anticipates another mass exodus in the coming weeks. As of last week, nearly 300 of the 1,000 uniformed officers in Seattle had not turned in paperwork showing they were vaccinated or were seeking an exemption, the mayor's office said. But scores more are believed to have been vaccinated since then. People believe in personal choice, and we, as a union, have to represent everybody, Salon said. We're not going to play the games of segregating between the vaxxed and the unvaxxed. It's not about that. This is about saving jobs. In recent weeks, judges have rejected attempts by a group of Oregon State Police troopers and Denver police officers to block vaccine mandates. Hashtag MeToo, 4 years in. I'd like to think now we are believed. By Jocelyn Novak and Mary Claire Dale, The Associated Press. New York. To Charlotte Bennett, the new book that arrived at her Manhattan apartment this week, Anita Hill's Believing, was more than just a look at gender violence. It was a dispatch from a fellow member of a very specific sisterhood, women who have come forward to describe misconduct they suffered at the hands of powerful men. Bennett's story of harassment by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo helped lead to his resignation after an investigation found he had harassed at least 11 women. And 30 years ago this month, Hill testified before a skeptical Senate Judiciary Committee that Clarence Thomas had sexually harassed her. I can't imagine what it was like doing that in 1991, said Bennett, 26. I've thought about that a lot. Hill's history obviously predates the hashtag MeToo movement, the broad social reckoning against sexual misconduct that reaches its four-year mark this week. But Bennett's moment is very much a part of it, and she believes hashtag MeToo is largely responsible for a fundamental change in the landscape since 1991 when Hill came forward. I'd like to think that now we are believed. Bennett said in an interview that the difference is we are not convincing our audience that something happened and trying to persuade them that it impacted us. I would really like to think we're in a place now where it's not about believability and that we don't have to apologize. But for Bennett, a former health policy aide in the Cuomo administration, what emboldened her to come forward and bolster the claims of an earlier accuser was also the feeling that she was part of a community of survivors who had each other's back. I was really scared to come forward, Bennett said, but something that reassured me even in that moment of fear was that there were women before me. It wasn't Charlotte versus the governor, but a movement moving forward. And I am one small event and one small piece of reckoning with sexual misconduct in workplaces and elsewhere. There's evidence Bennett is not alone in feeling a shift. 4 years after, actor Alyssa Milano sent her viral tweet asking those who had been harassed or assaulted to share their stories or just reply, "Me too." Following the stunning revelations about mogul Harvey Weinstein, most Americans think the movement has inspired more people to speak out about misconduct, according to a new poll. About half of Americans, 54%, say they personally are more likely to speak out if they're a victim of sexual misconduct, according to the poll from the Associated Press NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. And slightly more, 58%, say they would speak out if they witnessed it. 62% of women said they are more likely to speak out if they are a victim of sexual misconduct as a result of recent attention to the issue, compared with 44% of men. Women also are more likely than men to say they would speak out if they are a witness, 63% versus 53%. Sonia Montoya, 65, of Albuquerque, used to take the sexist chatter in stride at the truck repair shop where she has worked as the office manager, the only woman, for 17 years. But as news broke in 2016 about the crude way presidential candidate Donald Trump spoke about women, she realized she'd had enough. She demanded respect, prompting changes from her colleagues that stuck as the hashtag MeToo movement took hold. It used to be brutal, the way people talked at work. It was raw, said Montoya, a poll participant who describes herself as an independent voter and political moderate. Ever since this movement and awareness has come out, the guys are a lot more respectful, and they think twice before they say certain things. Justin Horton, a 20-year-old EMT in Colorado Springs who attends a local community college, said he saw attitudes start to change as the hashtag MeToo movement exploded during his senior year of high school. He thinks it's now easier for men to treat women with respect, despite a culture that too often objectifies them, and he hopes people realize that men can be sexually harassed as well. I feel like it's had a lasting impact, he said. I feel like people have been more self-aware. Close to half of Americans say the recent attention to sexual misconduct has had a positive impact on the country overall. Approximately twice the number say that it's been negative, 45% to 24%, the poll shows. As recently as January 2020, Americans were split over the impact of the movement on the country. Still, there are signs the impact has been unequal, with fewer Americans seeing positive change for women of color than for women in general. That dovetails with frequent criticism that the hashtag MeToo movement has been less inclusive of women of color. We haven't moved nearly enough in that area, hashtag MeToo founder Tarana Burke told the Associated Press in an interview last month. The APNORC poll also showed generational differences. More Americans under 30 said more likely to speak out if they are a victim, compared with older adults, 63% versus 51%. And 67% of adults under 30 said they are more likely to speak out if they witness sexual misconduct, compared with 56% of those older. There is a price for speaking out, Bennett told Cuomo. Despite having resigned, is still not taking true responsibility for his actions, and so her struggle goes on. He's still willing to try and discredit us, she said, and I am at a point where I'm exhausted. This has been a horrible experience. Bennett has said the 63-year-old Cuomo, among other comments, asked if her experience with sexual assault in college had affected her sex life, asked about her sexual relationships, and said he was comfortable dating women in their 20s. Cuomo denies making sexual advances and says his questions were an attempt to be friendly and sympathetic to her background as a survivor. He has denied other women's allegations of inappropriate touching, including an aide who accused him of groping her breast. How is Bennett doing 2 months after the resignation? She replies haltingly, I'm doing okay. Every day is hard. It's sad. It takes a piece of you a little bit. But I would make the same decision every single time. The reason I was in public service was to be a good citizen and give back and do the right thing and contribute. I didn't see my role like this, but that's what it's turned into. And that's okay. I'm proud of myself for coming forward, and I will get through it. She muses about where the country might be in 3 more decades. I think reflecting on Anita Hill's experience is a great way to understand how long 30 years is, she said. So what do I feel like the next big change will be for me? I think it's just not apologizing for being inconvenient. I could sit here and apologize, but I want to get to a place where we're not apologizing, where it's our job to come forward if we have the means and ability to do so. And the hashtag MeToo movement, she said, should be not only a community, not only a soft landing place for women who come forward. It should be where leaders come from, Bennett said. We know how institutions act. We know the underbelly of these institutions better than anyone. We have a lot of solutions to fix it, and we should be at the table. It should be our table. Meteorite crashes through ceiling and lands on woman's bed. Ruth Hamilton was fast asleep in her home in British Columbia when she awoke to the sound of her dog barking, followed by an explosion. She jumped up and turned on the light, only to see a hole in the ceiling. Her clock said 11:35 p.m. At first, Hamilton, 66, thought that a tree had fallen on her house. But no, all the trees were there. She called 911, and while on the phone with an operator, noticed a large charcoal gray object between her 2 floral pillows. Oh my gosh, she recalled, telling the operator, there's a rock in my bed. A meteorite, she later learned. The 2.8-pound rock, the size of a large man's fist, had barely missed Hamilton's head, leaving drywall debris all over my face, she said. Her close encounter on the night of October 3rd left her rattled, but it captivated the Internet and handed scientists an unusual chance to study a space rock that had crashed to Earth. On the night the meteorite crashed Hamilton's sleep, other Canadians had heard 2 loud booms and seen a fireball streaking across the sky. Some caught the phenomenon on video, according to University of Calgary researchers. After Hamilton called 911, she did not sleep the rest of the night, she said, and sat in a chair, sipping tea as the meteorite sat on her bed. Hamilton told local news outlets that she kept the news to herself at first, but she later reported the episode to researchers at the University of Western Ontario, where Peter Brown, a professor, confirmed the rock was a meteorite from an asteroid. Hamilton, who is retired, also told her family and friends, "My granddaughters can say that their grandmother just almost got killed in her bed by a meteorite," she said. Saywatch County. Searchers find body of climber who fell on Kit Carson Peak, by Jake Shapiro, The Denver Post. The body of an experienced and well-prepared climber was found by search crews in Saywatch County on Wednesday. The team battled extremely challenging conditions, but has yet to recover the body, partially because of harsh weather. Madeline Barhalu Kivi, a 29-year-old mountaineer, was in Class 5 terrain when she went off route and cliffed out below the usual Kit Carson Peak path. The Saywatch County Sheriff's Office received a call after 8 p.m. Monday for Barhalu Kivi. She was seeking help, and her GPS coordinates were relayed. Before dawn on Tuesday, plans were made to rescue Barhalu Kivi. A Black Hawk helicopter with hoist capability was made available at dawn just before an approaching winter storm, providing a narrow window of time for rescue operations. Authorities said in a news release that an aerial search of the given GPS coordinates and the surrounding area was conducted, but searchers were unable to locate the subject initially. At that point, the helicopter left the scene to refuel, but was unable to return because of rapidly deteriorating weather. Two ground teams were on location, but one was forced to turn back because of wind, snow, visibility, and cold. The other team fought through visibility conditions of less than 100 yards, but was unsuccessful before ultimately leaving because of the weather. On Wednesday, a combined mountain rescue team visually located Baharlu Kwivi at about 3 p.m. Air crews confirmed that Baharlu Kwivi was deceased from an apparent fall. She was near a vertical wall that made a hoist operation for body recovery unsafe. She just graduated from nursing school and was so excited to do what she loves, Roxanne Baharlu Kornbeiss wrote on a memorial Facebook page for Baharlu Kwivi. And one thing that she loved was her senior pug, Max, along with her friends and family. This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post for Saturday, October 16th, 2021. My name is Doug Crane. We invite you to please stay tuned for our next program.
Few people spend as much time in the wilderness and outdoors as hunters and anglers. And a new report aims to be a springboard to bring those conservationists and their knowledge into discussions of combating climate change. The report, titled A Hunter's and Angler's Guide to Climate Change, touches on a variety of landscapes throughout the country used by sportsmen and women that face environmental threats. Among them are the country's forests and rivers. Report author Aaron Kindle of the National Wildlife Federation says in Colorado, heat waves, droughts, and forest fires are hurting outdoor recreation in the state.
If your elk hunt is canceled because the unit that you are going to hunt in is burning down, that's clearly an impact on the ability to hunt. We saw historic closures this year in Colorado. Many rivers closed because of too hot of temperatures for trout. So those are the kind of things we're seeing that are really meaning our ability to hunt and fish is under threat.
Colorado had its first 200,000-acre forest fire in 2020. The report says natural infrastructure can offer some level of protection for these areas. Wetlands, forests, and floodplains in particular can prevent flooding and help purify water. Kindle says some of the immediate actions hunters and anglers can take to start contributing to the fight against climate change include taking part in reforestation efforts. But a big part of finding environmental solutions is by advocating for resources on the state and federal level.
We are a community of storytellers. We talk about the hunt, we talk about fishing, we talk about the seasons and how they've changed. And hunters and anglers have such a crucial narrative that would help shape those pieces of legislation into a better form.
Among the federal support named in the report is the Replant Act, which would quadruple investments in reforestation in national forests. It also suggests relaunching the Civilian Conservation Corps, a 1930s public works program, but with a focus on addressing climate change. I'm Emily Scott with Colorado News Connection. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Student housing may be the only real estate market.
This is the day we get to spotlight our favorite people.
Animals can teach us if we give.
Echemosle un vistazo a las condiciones.
We don't all have the living space, free time, and gumption.
This is the Audio Information Network of Colorado. Listen, learn, connect.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
The world will be watching to see if the U.S. will lead again, to see if the U.S. will cooperate with other nations and deliver on its international climate commitments.
The president of the Sierra Club, Ramon Cruz, is looking for President Joe Biden to walk into upcoming climate talks with historic investments in his briefcase. The president and first lady will travel to Europe in 2 weeks for the COP26 summit, where global leaders will discuss ambitious climate action, including the administration's goal of cutting U.S. carbon emissions in half by 2030. National Climate Advisor Gina McCarthy contends intensifying natural disasters are proof of just how high the stakes are.
And I'm not just talking about how we hand our children a future that we're proud of, but right here and right now, we have to protect our health. We have to protect our homes and our communities. We have to figure out how to work now if we hope to have success in shaping a sustainable future.
Before the summit, Biden will travel to the Vatican to meet with Pope Francis to discuss human rights and ending the pandemic. A bipartisan panel studying potential reforms to the Supreme Court says there are considerable risks to expanding the number of justices. Preliminary findings said court packing could undermine the High Court's legitimacy and lead to a continuous cycle of future expansions. The House committee investigating the January 6th Capitol riot will hold political strategist Steve Bannon in contempt for refusing to comply with a subpoena. Committee Chair Democratic Congressman Benny Thompson said the committee will use every tool at its disposal to get the information it requests.
We need to know minute by minute how January 6th unfolded. We need to understand how the rotten lie behind January 6th has continued to spread and feed the forces that would undermine American democracy.
Bannon's lawyer advised the panel his client will not provide testimony or documents until the committee reaches an agreement with former President Donald Trump over executive privilege or a court weighs in on the matter. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer says the chamber will vote next week on whether to debate a new election reform bill aimed at countering the growth of state-level Republican voting restrictions. Schumer warned Republicans failure to advance the legislation would prompt him to find a way to move it forward without them. The November general election is just around the corner, and the Virginia governor's race is in the national spotlight, with Democrat Terry McAuliffe and Republican Glenn Youngkin neck and neck. Jim Dow with Virginia AARP hopes voters will turn out.
After what we've seen in this country over the last however many years, where we've become increasingly divided, and hopefully by looking at elections as an opportunity to evaluate candidates based on their positions, their policy solutions, I think we'll find as a people that there's a lot more that unites us than divides us.
I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our A-Trust indicators to support accuracy and transparency online at publicnewsservice.org.